Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. News all over the world this week, but in America, it was all about Tucson. 20 shot, 6 dead, a congresswoman near death and back, and a country struggling to come to grips with what had happened, what it meant. In Tucson, with the shock still fresh, Sheriff Clarence Dupnik called out a national climate of anger.
When you look at unbalanced people, how they respond to the vitriol that comes out of certain mouths about tearing down the government, the anger, the hatred, the bigotry that goes on in this country is getting to be outrageous.
By midweek, the president called on the country to live up to its better angels and the expectations of Tucson's youngest victim, 9-year-old Christina Taylor Green.
I want America to be as good as she imagined it. All of us, we should do everything we can do to make sure this country lives up to our children's expectations.
And Sarah Palin went online to charge blood libel against those who looked in her direction after the killing.
Journalists and pundits should not manufacture a blood libel that serves only to incite the very hatred and violence that they purport to condemn. That is reprehensible.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jonathan Carl of ABC News, Margaret Carlson of Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. How are you responding to Tucson? What have we learned from Tucson? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Jonathan, Margaret, Jack, thanks to each of you for being here. Jonathan, first to you. The whole country is taking this on board. It's settling in everywhere. Everyone's come to grips, thought it through again, had second and third and fourth thoughts about it, maybe listened to so many voices. We heard some right there at the top of the hour. On Capitol Hill, is this a one-week story and then it's back to business or something else, Jonathan? How do you see it?
A little bit more, not necessarily much more, but this really shook the place. It's striking how you had the debate over the heated rhetoric, you know, the heated rhetoric about the heated rhetoric, all the finger-pointing back and forth. That was not seen on Capitol Hill. I sat there and watched when you had the debate. I mean, it wasn't really a debate, but when you had on Wednesday, the House passed this resolution honoring Giffords and the other victims. And the discussion was free of any, you know, any of that stuff. And now, of course, you see that the latest thing is this movement that is gaining some steam to have the State of the Union instead of having, you know, Democrats on one side, Republicans on the other side in the seating, have kind of boy-girl seating, you know, have Democrats and Republicans interspersed. And, you know, McCain has endorsed that idea. Steny Hoyer, the Democratic number two in the House, has endorsed that idea. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Republican-Democrat. That would certainly be a change in dramaturgy at the very least. Margaret Carlson, what about the lasting imprint of this week? I mean, it's all over the country people are thinking about and feeling and sharing and talking. What about in Washington? That would be something at the State of the Union. Health care vote put off this week. Does this insinuate itself? Does this work its way into some kind of change in our politics, Margaret?
Well, one thing we know is that at this State of the Union, there will be no one yelling out anything, much less you lie.
How do you know that? Who expected it last time? I mean, is it really all done, all gone? There's some pretty big polarization still.
Well, he became a hero. He's a hero no longer. You know, there has to be that change. I don't expect that there's going to be the kind of change that people like Carolyn McCarthy would like to see. Representative McCarthy's introducing a bill which would outlaw those magazines that allowed Loeffner to, without reloading, you know, shoot 20 people. Imagine if he hadn't had those magazines, who might be alive? You know, you could go through the list. I mean,
if he'd had to reach for a fresh magazine sooner, giving that opportunity for the woman who grabbed his hand, for the men who tackled him.
Yeah, yeah, those great people. You know, what instincts. I mean, they're like the first responders who run into a burning building.
Yes, they are.
These people were in jeopardy, and yet they did the heroic thing. They put their own lives in danger. Now, if you can contemplate that for a moment, you'd say, wouldn't this inspire our Congress to outlaw those? There's no good reason for them. And yet, even Congresswoman McCarthy says, the NRA has won. There are hardly any Democrats who will rise up because the NRA has proved themselves so powerful. If you get, no pun intended, in their sights, they can defeat you.
Of course, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords herself was a gun rights advocate in her posture.
Well, there are states in which you can't get elected without being pro-gun.
Jack, I want to talk about gun control, and I want to get your bigger picture as well. Let's listen to a couple of voices out of Congress this week, because, of course, this came very close to the thoughts of congresspeople, to see a fellow congressperson, woman, on the ground, bullet through the brain. Here is House Speaker John Boehner, who canceled all regular House business this week. On the House floor Wednesday, he gave an emotional speech calling for unity.
This is a time for the House to lock arms in prayer for the fallen and the wounded, and in resolve to carry on a dialogue of democracy. We may not yet have all the final answers, but we already have the answer that matters most, that we're Americans, and we'll make it through this difficult period.
John Boehner with his trademark emotionality there, but saying it straight up. Here's Representative Jim Clyburn, Democrat from South Carolina, talking with CBS News on Wednesday, saying Americans are responsible to call out fellow citizens for too angry, violent discourse.
We are going to be made to repent, not just for the vitriolic words and deeds of bad people, but for the appalling silence of good people. I do believe that the good people of America must speak out when we see these kinds of atmospheres being created.
And finally, here's Sarah Palin in a kind of presidential-style presentation on Facebook, flag at her side, saying, let's be careful on the blame front. This stands alone, stands on its own. To suggest otherwise, blood libel. Here she is.
Acts of monstrous criminality stand on their own. They begin and end with the criminals who commit them. Not collectively with all the citizens of a state, not with those who listen to talk radio, not with maps of swing districts used by both sides of the aisle, not with law-abiding citizens who respectfully exercise their First Amendment rights at campaign rallies, not with those who proudly voted in the last election.
Jack Beatty, there's Sarah Palin with her word on this, very carefully presented at some length, 7 or 8 minutes. What did you make of the whole week, Jack, of the president's response to this, of Sarah Palin's response to this, and beyond?
Well, I think Sarah Palin really showed at a disadvantage. As I'm reading about it, it sounds like she's had a really tough time, that there's been a huge surge in death threats just since Tucson.
Against her?
Against her, that's bad. And she's been reading the web and brooding on all the criticisms. And she reacted as someone with a narcissistic injury. You know, I'm a victim of Tucson. It really wasn't her proudest moment, especially when set against the noble notes the president sounded in his speech. It's been a tough time generally, I think, for Sarah Palin. Sometime earlier this year, Politico had anonymous Republicans just expressing dismay that she could be their nominee. You had just this week two Republican governors, one sitting governor and one just retired, Tim Pawlenty, criticizing her for various things. You really have to, when you look at this week's performance by her, you don't have to change George Will's pessimistic prognostication. He says that if she runs, she will lose 44 states. It doesn't sound like she gained another one this week. So it's been a tough time, it seems to me, for her, especially showing against the president.
John Carl, we heard James Clyburn there saying, watch out, we're going to have to repent, he said, for this vitriolic rhetoric. We all need to look and sort of call out those who take us down that road. On the other hand, here's Sarah Palin pushing back and saying, don't associate hot political rhetoric, which we've always had in this country, with one shooting in Arizona. Where do you think the needle is going to come down on this, John? Or will the country stay divided even on this, whether or not these are related?
Well, I think the president set the tone. You know what's interesting? You know, first of all, on Palin, let's face it, she was wrongly tarnished on this one.
Explain your logic there.
Well, I just, the victims had barely reached the hospital, and people were talking about Sarah Palin and her target map and implying, or in some cases, outright saying that there was a connection. Bernie Sanders put out a fundraising letter this week that went on and on about Sarah Palin and others and implying a direct linkage and suggesting that Arizona may not be safe for Democrats.
No atmospheric connection when you've got the gun sights on the target map, when it's don't retreat, reload, something
well,
she
you know,
says
thing,
with
shotgun
in hand.
It's one thing to talk about atmospheric connections. I mean, I don't even know. I haven't seen any evidence that Jared Loughner even knew who Sarah Palin was. There's no mention of her or her gun sights or her map in any of his writings that we have seen so far. It's clear that his obsession with Gabrielle Giffords dated back to 2007, before anybody really outside of Alaska knew who Sarah Palin was. Certainly you can have a discussion about the rhetoric and about whether or not the use of her, the use of the imagery was appropriate that she used in that map. But to suggest a connection between what happened it seems to me to be a real stretch. And that's what she was responding to. I think the unfortunate thing for Sarah Palin is she decided to put that thing out the same day that the president was giving his speech. And the comparison is not a good one for her, even though the substance of the message actually isn't that much different in terms of the president also saying don't point fingers.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the Tucson shooting and its aftermath, with Jonathan Karl of ABC News, Margaret Carlson of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Here was the president in that big University of Arizona arena in Tucson at the climax of his speech on Wednesday.
They believed, and I believe, that we can be better. Those who died here, those who saved lives here, they help me believe. We may not be able to stop all evil in the world, but I know that how we treat one another, that's entirely up to us. And I believe that for all our imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as those that unite us.
That we pray for. Let's get our callers in here. Brattleboro, Vermont. Jerry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi, gentlemen. I'm just so sick and tired of the Tucson saga. I think we have gone through this. I lived through the JFK and all the other assassinations, and frankly, we have learned nothing. This is such an extremely violent country, and it's promoted not only through our politicians and their poor choice of words, but also with the wars we encounter, the movies, the music. I mean, Obama has got a plate full that's overflowing, but I think this is the fault of the American people. Why don't they wake up and stop being so naive?
Naive about what exactly, Jerry?
Naive to the point where all we're doing is promote violence and we glorify war. Where are these memorials and church services from all of the soldiers that have come back? Obama would be on a daily basis visiting all of these funerals if he really was sincere.
There certainly is plenty of violence in our culture. There's no question about it. But here it came to a head in a parking lot at a Congress on the corner. Appreciate your call. One more. Cookeville, Tennessee. Another Jerry. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
What I kind of noticed this week was on NPR last Saturday when you had, I believe it was James Fallows was on.
Not me, but no doubt someone. Yeah, okay.
Well, right. Well, anyway, he was on, and I remember the first thing he was talking about was Sarah Palin and the Tea Party, and I was thinking, what did they have to do with anything about this? And then the rest of the news, not just because of him, James Fallows. I mean, there was other people in media, but everybody else just kind of piled on that. And then when more stuff started coming out about this young man, it seemed he was kind of enamored with the writings of Karl Marx and the Communist Manifesto.
And Ayn Rand and a whole lot of others. Let's be very factual on that, Jerry.
Correct. But yep. And I just kind of found it disingenuous just to try to blame it on one certain group when the only blame there was, I would say, would be with the healthcare system in this country with the mental health care.
Yeah, that's a big deal here. But Jerry, let us pick that straight up. And Margaret Carlson, let me come to you because this question comes back and back. And you know, here's another kind of divide. This, do we or do we not? Can we or can we not draw a bright line between this one troubled young man, and we don't know the whole story even now, and the culture of out there, violent rhetoric in this country, Margaret. Sarah Palin says no connection. Our caller Jerry is suggesting no connection. But can a bright line live there? We all live in the same country, the same culture.
Well, Tom, there aren't many bright lines in our life. You know, they're all muddled. I forgive James Fallows and others on air immediately after this for making a connection. This madman didn't go in and have his rampage in the Safeway. He had it in the parking lot at a political event. He tried to assassinate a congresswoman. It is not a leap to say our culture and our, in particular, our political culture may have had something to do with that. I mean, I still wince when I see the map with the crosshairs over a congressman. Woman Gifford's district.
She winced months ago. She said, look at this, Madam Palin. Things like this have consequences. One of them turned out to be a bullet in her brain.
And, the other piece of this, which the caller brought up, you know, in addition to gun control, we do need to get, you know, one of the first things to be cut in budgets is mental health funds. They were cut drastically in Arizona. There were lots of warning signs from this person. And as the facts emerged, somebody can correct me here because I don't have the timeline. The blaming went away. Sarah Palin was a couple days behind on this. I think the conversation had moved on to, he's a madman. Isn't this awful? What can we do? And on to what the president could do. And away from looking for scoundrels. I mean, you know, it didn't stop Rush Limbaugh, by the way, from saying that, the Democratic Party is 100% behind Jared Loughner. What kind of thing is that to say?
Jack, let me come to you, if I may. Sorry, Margaret, and thank you. But, Jack, personally, I'm not willing to just walk away from this cultural issue so quickly. Jared Loughner is a very troubled kid. But if we don't take an opportunity like this to sort of look in the mirror as a country and say, where are the edges of our rhetoric and what's being pumped out there that might create this kind of atmosphere where the first target is a politician at a Democratic meeting, I mean, an exercise of democracy in a supermarket parking lot, if we don't take the opportunity then to say, wait a minute, let's call out this language that may be pushing people in that direction, then when do we do it, Jack?
I quite agree. I mean, when? If it only goes so far as we prune our metaphors, you know, the promiscuous use of targeting and taking out and all the rest of that, I do think that may wane. I just think that now has it's beyond the pale. People will immediately be called out on that. So I think that may be a gain for us. But, you know, Jerry in Vermont just made an interesting connection. We're just speculating here about broad causes. Mm. But he was talking about the culture of war intersecting with the culture of violence at home. It's very interesting when you look back. I think one of our most sensitive presidents, sensitive to the national temper, was Woodrow Wilson. And just as the Americans were going into the war, he gave an interview to the Associated Press, and he said, once take this people into war, and the cop on the beat will no longer be safe. The deranged will get a signal. Violence will be legitimated. People will believe that this is the right thing to do. This will send all the wrong signals to our peaceable people. He was very aware that when the government is involved in mass killing and dignifying it and, in fact, justifying it, that, too, sends signals into the culture.
These are very hard and delicate things to tease out. Direct line, absolutely not. A culture, an atmosphere, much harder to say. Bob in Birmingham, Alabama. Bob, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Just to point it back briefly, Gabby Giffords herself last April said that she felt threatened by the violent rhetoric directed to her and specifically called out Sarah Palin's targeting map. It wasn't the media that made that up. It was Congresswoman Giffords.
Fair enough. There she was, a politician alert to the atmosphere and articulating her concern right there. Yes, she did, Bob. I appreciate that. Omaha, Nebraska. Paul, you're on the air, Paul.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
You know, every time I hear these you know, national emergencies and national crises, we go into this self-flagellation mode and we throw our hands in the air and we look for a, you know, some sort of a culprit, whether it be a Sarah Palin or whether it be a Rush Limbaugh or whatever.
Should we not do some self-reflection at a time like this, Paul? Should we not?
No, I think it is, but I think we all should be looking in the mirror because this has been a... We've gotten here in small baby steps, whether we're talking about education or whether we're talking about public discourse or the way Congress behaves. Everybody has you know, ownership in this problem. We have just... It reminds me of a title of a book that I think is Robert Bork wrote years ago called Slouching Towards Gomorrah. You know, we have just incrementally gone downhill in this society by making excuses that our movies are not promoting violence, that, you know, every time there is something that chips away at civility of this country, we make an excuse and make some sort of apology that it's okay. And it isn't. Collectively, all of these little incremental steps add up, and it just breeds this entire environment where this kind of stuff goes on.
Paul, I really appreciate your call. Jonathan Carl, you're listening patiently, I presume thoughtfully there. And it brings me back to Washington and what's going on there. It was soon enough. The health care bill will be back on the table. Republicans will go at it. That's their right. That's democracy. What about this issue of a sort of general decline in our interactions, in the discourse? Is there a way to turn that around? Paul Krugman writes today in the New York Times, very tough to do. We've got fundamentally different views of what should be going on in this country. But President Obama says, okay, fine, but let's talk about it. Let's talk this through, certainly not shoot our way through it.
Yeah, I mean, the differences can be dealt with much more civilly. And I've watched these. I've covered, you know, so many of these debates now. And and it's on both sides, and it really is disheartening. And it's you know, the way Bush and Cheney were vilified by the left, often with some of the very same violent imagery and you know, very unsubtly.
Gun sights.
It is
rifles at rallies.
Oh, sure.
Really?
When you're calling, you know, George Bush or Dick Cheney, you know, a war criminal, blood on their hands, you know, and I mean, this is inciting as well. I mean, it is. And actually, there was a very moving speech given earlier this week by Joe Kennedy III up there in Boston before the legislature. Talking about this, and he, I thought he very thoughtfully called out all the rhetoric on all sides, and he cited specific examples, you know, on the left as well. But you know, I think the reason why this will lead to some civility, at least in Capitol Hill, at least in the short term, and maybe in the midterm as well, is what this did is this reminded all of them how vulnerable they are, so that, you know, not that there was any connection here. You know, not that Loeffner was acting because he was egged on by the Tea Party, because he was outraged about healthcare, because he read Sarah Palin's map. I mean, but they realized they are out there, and when you have this kind of rhetoric flying around, and this kind of anger, you know, you may see that the next person might be somebody that was egged on by this, and it all kind of brought it home.
Let's get another call from Omaha. Stuart is calling from Nebraska. Hi, Stuart, you're on the air.
Yeah, one thing I'm definitely learning from this, from what happened in Tucson, is that you know, the language being used by the media to explain the actions of this guy.
Yes.
It's totally different than what they would be if the guy would have been Muslim or if he would have been black.
In what way, Stuart? In what way?
Well, I mean, say for instance, the guy that, you know, shot up the army base in Texas a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
He was called all kind of radicals and potential terrorists and, you know, an Islamic radical, Islamo-radical,
yeah.
Whatever how they be saying. But, you know, this Jared Loughner cat, even though it's been proven that he was a conspiracy theorist, you know,
yes.
He's not being called a radical. He's not being called a terrorist, even though his actions have been the same.
He's been being called mentally unstable.
He's being called mentally unstable. He's not being called something that will make other people look at other people just like him in a different way. You know what I'm saying?
That is very interesting. Stuart, I appreciate your call. Jack, what about it? There's a caller saying, what, if he'd been Muslim or black, we might not have given him there is a kind of humanity in recognizing mental instability rather than just saying terrorist.
Yes, of course, that doesn't, it doesn't argue against the pathology in Major Hassan. I mean, he clearly was a very disturbed person as well.
Which was called out as well.
Yes, it was, and there were long-standing signals of that, as in this, and people didn't follow through, and the problems that Margaret was talking about in just articulating a connection between observations of pathology or disturbed people and some sort of response, all that broke down in that case as well. You know, it looks like in many of these cases, you've got this individual pathology, and then around it, this, in the case of Major Hassan, this ideological justification. But what comes first? What has to come first? We have to believe. Well, I suppose that isn't the case with Islamic terrorists abroad, or who knows. But one wants to think what comes first is the pathology, that people don't really go out and just kill over political ideology.
Of course, we know some do. Armies do. Michael in Northampton, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am wondering why the nation has not focused on this breakdown from observation, as you pointed out, to action. As your commentator just mentioned, not everybody will go out and commit these types of crimes. We clearly have an understanding that some significant mental health issue is at play, both with Major Hassan and with the Jared Loughner case. Why are we not discussing what we do as a country?
Well, there has been some, but what's the answer? What's the big answer on that front, Michael?
What's the big answer?
Yeah.
I think it certainly is personal responsibility, but I'm not actually sure what the big answer is. I don't know what's causing the breakdown, but my question is, why are we not talking about it?
Personal
responsibility. We're not talking about, despite all these signals, significant enough action was not taken to hospitalize Jared, to provide some kind of service for him so he would not be capable of committing these crimes.
I appreciate your call. Margaret Carlson, of course, a lot of those facilities have been cut back over the years. And then there's the personal responsibility to look out and say, this guy is in trouble and we need to think about it as a community and do something.
Tom, the healthcare bill that Republicans want to have some street theater over and repeal gives some kind of parity with gives some kind of parity of mental health care with physical health care. This is a great step forward because, as we can see, those who are neglected can do horrible things.
You mean the reform package that was passed last year would do that if it went forward?
It attempts to give some parity in our insurance. Jack made this point earlier, which is, just because Loughner is a madman doesn't mean that we shouldn't look at these other things, that our political discourse isn't incivil, and that putting crosshairs isn't a bad thing, and gun sights aren't a terrible thing. Just because this guy turned out not to have a political philosophy doesn't mean that our political discourse isn't in a perilous state.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, snow and ice slammed the eastern seaboard from Georgia to Maine.
They call it a weather bomb pounding the East Coast. Look at that screen. Causing a major headache for millions of Americans.
Political moves by Iran and Syria-backed Hezbollah toppled the government of Lebanon. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was sharply critical.
We view what happened today as a transparent effort by those forces inside Lebanon, as well as interests outside of Lebanon, to subvert justice and undermine Lebanon's stability and progress.
And Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords looked out on the world, then moved her arms and legs. She's now sitting up, responding, we're told. Her neurosurgeon, Dr. Michael LaMole, said he was amazed by her progress.
Miracles happen every day, and in medicine we like to very much attribute them to either what we do or others do around us, but a lot of medicine is outside of our control, and we're wise to acknowledge miracles.
All that on our minds, plus in Brazil, you saw the terrible sort of rain and mudslides there with Brazilians, very high number of deaths, maybe hundreds, maybe 500 confirmed dead so far, and the rain just keeps coming. Jonathan Carl is with us this hour, senior political correspondent for ABC News. Margaret Carlson is here, columnist for Bloomberg News, Washington editor for The Week magazine, and our own Jack Beattie. Let's get a call from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think it's hypocritical of the government to look at firearms and try to ban them. It's like a carpenter hitting his thumb with a hammer and then a non-carpenter saying, oh, let's ban hammers. There are thousands of people killed every day by drunk drivers, yet alcohol's okay, you know, because they have a big lobby. We have a government that is in the business of training our young people to kill other people in the military by the thousands and have done it for decades.
Jim, I understand what you're saying. I grew up with guns, but let me ask you, Jim, what about in this particular case? You know, are there some fine points, some subtleties here? For example, if someone's really mentally unstable, rejected from the army.
They should not be able to have firearms, but this guy wasn't tagged by anybody.
Well, I mean, the army didn't take him. His college threw him out. It's not as though he wasn't vaguely out there on the screen, but there wasn't a law to say no to this, as far as I know, John Carl, in Arizona. Even if he, you know, to the extent he'd been seen as a troubled character, there was nothing to stop him from going in and buying that Glock with the great big magazine on it.
Yeah, I mean, it is something, and that's got to be looked at. I mean, whatever your position is about gun control or not, you know, I think that even if you are the most fervent Second Amendment advocate you could possibly be, you don't want a guy like this buying a gun. But, you know, it's interesting, Tom. If you look at the gun control debate over the last 15 years in this country, after each one of these, you know, major tragedies, you know, from Columbine on down, the support for gun control has actually in the polls waned, and certainly in the Congress. This was the most pro-NRA Congress we saw over the last 2 years that I have ever seen. I mean, they, you know, legalizing guns in national parks, legalizing guns on Amtrak. The NRA was very happy with this democratically controlled Congress. And frankly, I don't see that changing after this.
Well, we will be hearing more about it. We'll talk more about it here next week. But there's legislation coming from Congresswoman Carolyn McCarthy, Democrat from New York, and of course famous because her husband was murdered, her son seriously injured in 1993 when another disturbed gunman with a whole lot of bullets and a big magazine opened fire on a Long Island commuter train. She talked with NPR Tuesday about why she's proposing a ban on high capacity equipment after the Tucson shootings.
With the large amounts of bullets that were held in the magazine, he was able to spray and shoot, unfortunately, an awful lot of very innocent victims. I think when you think about just common sense here, large capacity clips that can basically, in my opinion, the weapons of mass destruction should not be available to the average citizen.
Jack Beattie, what do you see coming on the inevitable gun control debate? The headlines already say it's going to be out there, it's going to be talked about, and it's not going to pass.
I'm afraid that looks like the way things will shape up. You know, as a paradigm of what Jonathan was saying, the strength of the NRA, I read this week in Think Progress that since 2006, when under the Patriot Act, the director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was to be confirmed by the Senate. Well, since 2006, when that went into effect, there has been no director. Why? Because the NRA vetoed the Bush nominee, and they have certainly vetoed the Obama nominee.
Arms, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms?
That's right.
No chief all that time?
That's right. There's no director all that time because of the grip of the NRA in the Senate. Rural state senators have simply put blocks on these things for various, you know, that the nominees weren't as pure as the NRA wanted. Well, of course, what the NRA, you know, the NRA, as E.J. Dionne put it the other day, plays a long game. I mean, they've been at this all my life and really, I think, doing baneful work. And the only way to counter it is with another long game. And Bill Clinton some years ago said, you know, if you really want good gun laws, laws that would prevent or at least go as far as civilization can to preventing this kind of atrocity, then you've got to talk. People who are against, who want gun control have got to talk to the hunters. They've got to, he almost was putting it this way, there needs to be missionary work. A foundation needs to put money into setting up meetings all over the country where victims of gun violence and hunters can talk. And people can see that, no, we're not going after your guns. And people who are, you know, want gun control can see, boy, you know, guns are an important part of people's culture. We need to respect them. And especially now, this is a propitious moment because the Supreme Court now has made guns a personal right. No one can take them away. It should be a moment to begin that long game.
To some, make some fine distinctions, Margaret, how do you see that rolling out in Congress? Is there some chance, any chance of anything here, or it will be talk about it and then nothing?
Well, when the weapon, the assault weapon ban expired in 2004, you could hardly, Democrats hardly whimpered. You know, it just happened because the power of the NRA, which has been very quiet this week, is such that you don't want to go against them, even on things that are so obvious. I don't think, Jack, that hunters want to keep magazines for sale. If you were to pull them, they get the distinction. But the NRA makes it as if no one does get the distinction, and any infringement means that your gun is going to be taken away, when that certainly isn't the case. As you said, it's now been affirmed as your constitutional right.
Let's go to Josh, calling from Boston. Josh, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to comment on an earlier statement before about how incidents like these should compel us to take a good hard look in the mirror and figure out where we're at and where we need to be. And, mm-hmm. I think that in the wake of this tragedy, to point the finger at Sarah Palin is one thing, but to really understand that Sarah Palin is simply a politician like many politicians who are trying to fight their way into the fray and sort of make a name and build a base. I think her attempt to tap into a larger sentiment and her ability to gain support by doing things like putting gun sites on her web and talking about not retreating but reloading reflects a larger sentiment that's frankly somewhat disconcerting and somewhat scary to me in this country and is brought about by larger pieces of media, like, for instance, the Learning Channel that had Sarah Palin with shotguns and Kate Gosselin with her children on a camping trip in Alaska, or an incredible amount of graphic and very realistic violence that we have in all sorts of media, like video games and other things that are much more endemic in this country and really we need to take a good sort of systemic look at, as opposed to sort of pointing the finger at an individual person.
Josh, let us pick it up right there. I mean, it's interesting, Jonathan Carl, you know, if we're going to think about if there's larger sentiment at work here, there's one instinct, which is to look at some of, let's say, the imagery used by the Palin campaign or her own language and say, that's inciting. There's another, and maybe it's implicit in what President Obama said the other night, that's saying we have to listen to each other. If Sarah Palin, you may not like the way she's packaged it, but if she represents a large body of unease in this country, let's listen to that. Let's pay attention to that. I mean, you know, you get into the fine points here, John Carl.
Yeah, and you get into the vilification of the other side, and you see it. I mean, look, I think it is important to draw a bright line, frankly, you know, between what happened and the rhetoric. But let's look at the rhetoric.
I'm going to disagree with you there. I want to hear your thoughts, absolutely, but I think rhetoric matters. What you say matters. What you model for people who follow you matters. That doesn't mean don't pay attention to the issues that people represent.
Yeah, yeah. No doubt. The rhetoric matters, but there is no indication that the rhetoric had anything to do with what happened in Tucson. I think that's important to just say and just get out there. But if you look at this, I mean, we don't even listen to the other side anymore. I mean, you now have political parties who can actually get their own news. You know, you can actually spend the entire day listening to only those telling you what you want to hear.
Yep.
And you don't engage the other side at all. You don't listen at all. And I think it is problematic. And you know, this thing may be silly with the State of the Union and you know where people are going to sit. But I think symbolically, it's it is significant if they can do this. And the silly game that we see every year at the State of the Union of one side applauding, one side sitting down, and the back and the forth. You know, because that does send a message to the rest of the country.
I think symbols are very important. You know, symbols really are important. Rick in Aiken, South Carolina. Thanks for calling, Rick. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. One thing I wanted to say, you've just heard and you've heard it before, but I think the premise of juxtaposing the tragedy with any discussion of our political discourse is completely artificial. I mean, there is not one scintilla of one shred of even suggestion of evidence that the two are connected in any way. And I really was super frustrated listening to Monday's program. I just couldn't get to a phone to share that. But I wanted to follow up with, if I were to accept that premise, or one were to accept that premise, you'd have to agree that actions speak much, much louder than words. So regardless of anything Sarah Palin has said or others have said, I mean, if we're talking about incivility, I mean, we probably should be more likely to be talking about the administration's failure to prosecute Black Panthers with baseball bats in front of a polling station, an actual institution of the country.
Did they kill somebody, Rick?
Or even Juan Williams firing and then being called crazy by Vivian Schiller, you know. Those are actions. I mean, what Sarah Palin, you know, whatever she says, but it really felt like Monday was a knee-jerk reaction when the program could have been used to talk about mental health or even gun control, a progressive cause. It was completely wasted in this reaction to jump to Sarah Palin and to say that they're to try to make a connection even when they're absolutely isn't a connection.
Rick, I completely hear you. And you know what? I think that civility, and you're suggesting this, civility is not just talking nice. Civility is also listening carefully. And it means listening across political lines. It means listening to what maybe positions that you don't want to hear. But it's hard for me to think that our political discourse, which is big, which is a big envelope, we all live in it. It's hard for me to think that it has no connection to the way we all live. All of us, maybe including Jared Loughner. That's different from drawing any direct line to Sarah Palin, but isn't part of what we should learn this week to step back and all of us think about how we relate to one another, our rhetoric, what we put out there as models for action and interaction, Rick? Isn't that fair?
It is, but separate from any discussion of that particular tragedy. I mean, Jack just recently used really the words of war to describe a culture of death. And we could introduce abortion to that discussion as well. And those are discussions we should be having about our society, but all separate from, you know, crazy people do crazy things. I'm not aware of any physician, psychiatrist who will tell you that rhetoric resulted in schizophrenia.
Rick, I appreciate your call very much. And Jack, I mean, you know, when you get into self-reflection, things can open up very wide. And you start to look at the whole of a society, the whole of a culture, and then one incident in the middle of that. And yes, the web, it's hard to draw with a yes. drafting tool. And nevertheless, here we live. Here we are. You hear Rick's frustration with the connection. At the same time, you've got a lot of people who are very seriously concerned. And this is not just Democrats by the tone of political discourse in this country, and have found an opportunity here to speak to that concern.
And I think the president was addressing that urgently. And, you know, quite a part, you know, we wonder, is there empirical evidence that there's, you know, worse, that things are worse in terms of polarization and threats of violence and so on? Well, we do have some quantitative evidence. According to something I've read just the other day, there's been a 300% increase in threats to members of Congress just in the first few months of, just in the last few months of 2010. And since January 2009, since President Obama was inaugurated, there's been a 400% increase in threats against the White House. Now, I'm not saying there's any connection between rhetoric in the political arena and that phenomenon. But nobody surely wants to say there's no connection, or that these are just two distinct streams that are out there that never connect. And is there, do politicians just unconsciously, I'm not saying deliberately, occasionally wink at this sentiment, occasionally pander to it, occasionally tweak it right where its paranoid fears burn fiercest? I don't know, but those are frightening numbers, it seems to me, about the rising level of sort of expressed threats in our democracy.
Rick, I really do appreciate your call, Rick, and I'll say one thing. It does take open ears. It takes open ears on all sides to listen very carefully to fellow Americans, whatever their political stripe, very carefully. Jonathan, when do we get back to business as usual on Capitol Hill, or at least business? Starting Monday? When does it start to roll again on Congress?
They'll be back next week, and the health care vote, the repeal vote, will be on Wednesday. So we're right back at it.
We'll be talking about all these issues right on through. Listeners, we appreciate you being with us. Jonathan Karl, senior political correspondent with ABC News, thank you for your insights and time today, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Margaret Carlson with Bloomberg News and The Week. Margaret, thank you for joining us on
Thanks,
this day
Tom.
And this week. Thank you, Margaret. And Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, what a week. Let's reflect and see if we can't do things better. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.